We brought you just a snippet of our interview with Gay Byrne on Friday, which made the news around the country. Let's bring you the interview in full now. As presenter of RTE's flagship chat show, The Late Late Show, for 37 years, Gay Byrne became an Irish TV legend, of course, made the programme an institution, holds a special place, doesn't it, in Irish society to this day. In the past week, we played you part of the interview that you're about to hear. There was a huge reaction to his controversial comments when he says he would consider taking his own life if he was in pain near death. Gay's actually back in Belfast tonight. At the Belfast Festival at Queen's. So let's bring you the interview in full now. I began by asking Gay Byrne what memories he has from his first day as host of The Late Late Show.
Day one of The Late Late Show, well, my memory was that I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and the right fellow, because RTE was just starting. It was in the very first year. A studio was vacant, the biggest studio I had, which was then Studio One, and somebody wanted to use it for some reason or another and make use of it and keep it in operation. And I had been at that time 3 years with Granada Television in Manchester, reading the evening news and doing a daily programme called People and Places. And when I say I was just the right man in the right place at the right time, when Tom McGrath, the progenitor of The Late Late Show, got the idea of doing The Late Late Show, and he, in turn, had been a floor manager in CBC in Toronto and had seen regularly The Tonight Show with Jack Parr long, long before Johnny Carson. And he wanted to recreate that in Ireland. And he was looking around for somebody to introduce it. And on the basis that in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, I was the only one around with 3 years' experience or thereabouts of television. And he asked me to do it. And it's as simple as that. We wanted to use the studio to make use of it during the summer, solely as a summer filler. The show was put in as a sort of a talk show, cheapo, easy to do, and that was the start of it.
Isn't that incredible, though, how so little thought, so little, if you think of the execs these days and how they wrap themselves up in knots about how to create big programmes, and there's one of the most successful programmes ever on television,
well, isn't
created
it always
by chance.
Isn't it always that way, Stephen? It's a random choice. And remember that we were dealing with a brand new toy, this magic thing that had come to Ireland. It started on January of that year, and we were still playing around with it. And the people ask, you know, did you plot and plan all of this along the way? The answer is we had a brand new toy. We were like kids in a sweet shop. We didn't know what to do with it, and we were trying all sorts of things. And all sorts of things that we tried didn't come off, but a lot of things did, and you're quite right. It started, The Late Late Show started in August, in July, and for the first 3 or 4 weeks, people detested it because they had been told that this thing called The Late Late Show was coming. They thought what they were going to get was a variety show, a variety concert like on Sunday night. And instead of that, they got people talking and they couldn't bear it and they detested it. And then slowly but surely, over the course of a couple of weeks, they came round to liking it. And come September, and it was left in for the autumn schedule and then left in the following year and then went on.
Who decided to make it as controversial as it became? Was that you?
I did, because when I came back from London and I was sort of headhunted, I continued to do it off and on, coming back and forth from London, but that became not very amenable, to say the least. And the then controller of programmes, a Swedish guy called Gunnar Ruggheimer, came to London and asked me to come back permanently. And I said, yes, I'll come back, but only on the basis that I am my own producer. And that was a telling moment. Because that was a very unusual thing to be. But when I came back, I realised that whereas we were delighted to have Hollywood-style personalities and celebrities whenever we could get them, but the throughput of those in Dublin was miserable compared with the throughput of those, the footfall of those people in London. And so we had to fill the show with something else. And the only other thing we could fill the show with was people talking about things that mattered.
And one thing, Gay, to be your own producer, I guess some people might think that's ultimate arrogance, that no one can be as good as you.
Well, again, it was a random choice because I found that I was coming back from London at this stage now, doing The Late Late Show. I was working for the BBC in London, BBC Two, which I didn't like very much. And I was coming back every week to find a different producer was in charge of The Late Late Show. And the different producer was whoever happened to be hanging around the corner, not doing very much with anything else.
Yeah.
And Gunnar said to him, "Hey, you, what are you doing? Nothing right. You're in charge of the Late Late Show this week." And it was never anybody's show. It was never anybody's job to put a shape on it or whatever. And I realized it couldn't continue like that. So I might as well do it as anybody else. And that's how I became my own.
And some people might take it for granted now. The type of subject you were covering at that time, a younger generation wouldn't realise just how special it was for the Late Late Show to be taking on the church, the state, to be talking about abortion, homosexuality.
All of those
in that
things,
era.
All of those things, and these were things that were in everybody's mind and in everybody's conscience, but nobody was doing anything about them. And the show gradually became, as it were, the town hall of the air. This is the place to express your points of view and your rants and your ravings and so on. But I was rather careful that if we did a sort of a very, very, very serious show this week, and we might do that, we did a very light show the following week and the week after that. We got in comedy into it and music and variety and so on, because I didn't want to turn people off. The great secret of the show was we never told anybody who was going to be on. We never came out at the start and said, "Tonight we have daddy, 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 da." We never said anybody. So it was very much a matter of a lucky dip when people switched on the Late Late Show. They didn't know what to expect. They didn't know what kind of a show they were going to get that particular week. And that kept them guessing.
And if
they missed something good, they were regretful. And if they didn't miss anything good, they'd nothing to lose.
And as the programme became more and more successful, and therefore over the years, more and more powerful, how much pressure did you come under behind the scenes from the power brokers of society? Did you get threats? Did they try to intimidate you?
Absolutely. The very, very powerful people around the country for a long time were extremely anti-RTE and anti the Late Late Show and anti-Gay Byrne. But there were other programs that offended them as well, because it is impossible to explain to young people now the significance which people attached to anything that appeared on television, because it was a brand new toy, because it was a brand new influence in their lives.
But in what way were you threatened?
Well, in what way was I threatened?
Yeah.
Well, the people who were the power brokers in the country up to that time, I'm talking about the hierarchy, the clergy, the politicians, the local county councillors, the local fairly low-down officials who were forces in their local area, realized that this damn thing called television and this bloody fellow called Gay Byrne and the Late Late Show were undermining their authority and their influence, and they wanted something done about it. Something must be done about this. And they wanted the government to regain complete control. So those people used extreme pressure to get rid of Gay Byrne and get rid of the Late Late Show.
But share it with me. What did they do?
Well, they used influence on the minister. We were still under the aegis of the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, just as we're under the control of a minister now, as indeed you are. And they used pressure on the Director General, on the Controller of Programmes. And if we hadn't had very strong people like Kevin McCourt at that time and Gunnar Rugheimer, and indeed Eamon Andrews, who was chairman of the authority, he went through a spell of being under extreme pressure about the Late Late Show.
And did you feel that pressure?
Well, you realise that your head was on the block every week. You realise your head was on the block every week.
And were you the type of character that made you... Did that make you... You see, I get something similar in
yes.
Northern Ireland sometimes. And
yes.
Whatever type of character I am, it drives me even further to make sure that they have had no effect. Was that the impact on you?
No, I had a very fine technique of withdrawing hastily when there was a mad row going on, when there was another great confrontation pending. I had the ability to withdraw and sort of hide and just do my thing and then come back again. And you tend to play these people at their own game, because in every country where television starts, the first thing that people in authority try to do is get control of broadcasting, because they think, quite wrongly, but nobody will ever tell them, or nobody can ever persuade them, they think quite wrongly that if they can control broadcasting, they have it made and they're home and dried. And they keep on trying to get control of it. And remember, these were people who had complete control of the old Radio Éireann in the GPO. And so this new thing, which was very, very powerful, and they were right, it was undermining their authority, and it has undermined their authority in extraordinary ways. But they knew that this was coming, and they wanted to get control of it. Small blame to them.
And in that daily, in that weekly cycle then of the TV show, you're becoming bigger and bigger. You're getting more and more powerful. Is that easy to handle as a human being when you become one of the most influential people in the country?
I never saw it like that. I was just trying to keep the show on the air. And whatever was the opposite to boredom was my meat. It sounds a peculiar way to describe it. But whether it was fun and comedy and singing and dancing or an extreme row on air amongst people who felt strongly about things, that was the opposite of boredom, and that's what I wanted to do.
I'm not even on the remotely on the scale that you were on, because but people probably won't believe this about me, but I actually don't have. I have often told people who ask me, I kind of think I'm a bluffer that's lucky enough to be doing it. I don't quite know how it happens every week and doesn't fall apart, but it doesn't. And I remember watching you on television, and I'm trying not to sound sycophantic here, but I do mean it. You are and were an incredible broadcaster, just incredible. How effortlessly you held that whole program together was extraordinary. Now, it therefore becomes part of your life, and to then say in 1999 you're giving up a huge part of your life, that would terrify me. Did it terrify you?
Not particularly. I think that when you get to that stage in your life, and I was 65, I think everybody starts thinking, how long more have I got left in this life on this earth? And whatever length it is, do I want to spend it doing this, continuing to do this? And my life at that time, I was doing a radio program 5 days a week, 2 hours every day, mm-hmm. as well as producing The Late Late Show, as well as performing The Late Late Show. So it became a 6.5 day week. And you begin to think, how long more do I want to spend of my life doing a 6.5 day week at work? And the answer is not a lot. Like, let's cut it now.
You were sick of it?
No, I wasn't sick of it, but I knew that I didn't want to continue doing it. And you lose a little of your enthusiasm. As the Americans say, Popeye eventually runs out of spinach, and you just feel that you're not up to it to the same extent anymore. But I made it clear on day one that I intended to continue at a softer pace and at my own pace, doing bits and pieces for as long as I was able to do it, for as long as I was being invited to do it, for as long as I found it interesting. And that's exactly what I've done. I'm a very, very, very lucky man indeed.
You got out of it, Gay, did you miss it? And when you were watching it and you saw other people hosting it, were you comparing what they were doing you did it?
There were odd moments when you think, I would love to have interviewed that guy, I would love to have taken that item, I would love to still be there and so on. But that vanishes very quickly, and you realise that was then, this is now, you're moved on to a different aspect of your life. It's as simple as that, it really is. And I never had to walk down the driveway and hand over the keys and say, that's it, I'm gone, I'll never be here again. Because yeah. I was back very regularly doing various series, and I'm still going in and out. I'm still going in and out every Sunday. I do a program for Lyric FM in Montrose. So I'm in Montrose every Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4. Well, longer than that. But I do a program from 2 to 4, and I enjoy that. And I'm still doing Meaning of Life. And indeed, we are publishing Book 2 of Meaning of Life, the interviews which I do on all aspects of people's belief. We're publishing Book 2 this week.
Well, the Meaning of Life, one of your guests was the Ian Paisley.
Yes. And he actually, this book is a book of transcripts of the interviews which I did on Meaning of Life, and he is included in this new book. He's one of the interviewees.
What did you make of him?
Well, he was extremely courteous. We travelled up to his church, which is a beautiful place, incidentally. I'm sure you've been.
I have, yeah.
You've seen it. It really is very, very impressive indeed. He was most courteous, most friendly, most smiling and happy and all of those good things. And what is amazing about him was the fact that he actually believes that the words of the Old Testament as printed are literally true. That there was a garden, and there was himself and herself, and there was a tree and an apple, and there was a snake. And that the serpent did come in and say to her, have a go at the apple, you'll be as good as your man. He literally believes that is true. And I thought when I sadly heard of his death, I thought, well, there's a man gone to meet his Maker, firm in the belief, utterly and totally firm in the belief that his Redeemer does liveth, and that there is a warm, snug little abode set aside for him, specifically in the celestial fields somewhere. And I thought that if that doesn't turn out to be true, he's going to be one hell of a disappointed man.
Did you like him?
It would be hard to say that I liked him. I found him very pleasant and pleasingly welcoming.
Why would it be hard to say you liked him?
Because you remember what he was like in the olden days and when he was young and the amount of hatred that he spewed out and nurtured and engendered and all of those things. And you have to remember those things. But then you have to remember that it took a great man to switch and be seen to be side by side at the table of peace with people like Martin McGuinness and so on.
McGuinness, who you called a liar during the presidential campaign.
I probably did, yes. I don't have very much sympathy with Sinn Féin, but let's not get into that. But I found Ian Paisley very nice. Lord rest him. That's all you can say about him.
Why did you shy away from becoming President of Ireland or giving yourself the opportunity to become President of Ireland? The polls were looking good for you at one stage.
Well, it came as a bolt from the blue. I got a phone call one day from a radio programme to say that they had been doing surveys with a list of 10 names for their listeners to choose from to be the next, potentially the next President of Ireland. And when the returns came back, the number of listeners contacted by them, they had leapfrogged over all the 10 names and said Gay Byrne should be the next president, and Gay Byrne wasn't even on the list. So I got this phone call to tell me this, and I thought that's very nice and so on. And then the thing just started generating momentum of its own, and all kinds of extraordinary people were on the bandwagon offering help. People wanting to do my advertising for me, my public relations for me, to go out canvassing, to make posters, to do this, to raise money, all of that sort of thing. And so I had to give it some consideration out of politeness and out of courtesy and manners. But I realized then that the only reason you go for the presidency of Ireland is because you really, 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 really want to be president of Ireland. And at no stage in my life, amongst the many things that I ever wanted to be, nowhere in the list was presidency of Ireland. And I didn't particularly want to do that.
Why not, though?
Why not?
Yeah.
Because I didn't think that I wanted to be President of Ireland. It's very hard to explain, but I just don't want to be President of Ireland.
And was that because of the stage in your life you were at, where you were getting, I guess, tireder? You wanted a less intense schedule?
Yes, that would certainly be part of it. And it didn't attract me one way or the other anyway. But certainly part of it would have been that I knew how busy a life it is, and that you are giving away your life for the next 7 years to be where other people want you to be every hour of every day. And that didn't appeal to me because I'd had a very, very busy life until then. And I didn't want to leap from one prison into another prison. And anyway, the whole idea never crossed my mind. And I had to let people know fairly soon, please, in the immortal words of what's his name, the famous movie mogul, include me out.
When you said prison, did you say prism or prison?
Prison. Prison. Jail.
You describe your time in television as jail?
Well, it became a jail because I was there 6.5 days a week. And it became a jail. And in order to give it the full
attention... But jail's a punishment, Gay.
No, not as a punishment. It probably became a punishment in later years, getting near the end. And that would have propelled me out of it. I merely use it as a description of the presidency. Your life is gone, and if you want to volunteer to do that, that's fine. If that's what you want to do, if it attracts you, and in fact, our president Michael D. Higgins is a wonderful president, I think, and everything in his life, in his political life so far, was actually, when you look back at it, it was leading inexorably towards being president of Ireland. And that's what he wanted to be. And so did Mary McAleese and so did Mary Robinson. They wanted to be President of Ireland.
What is the meaning for life for you now? What is it that you want to? You see, I'm 40. I'm 41 now. I forgot.
You're only
about,
a child.
I forgot about that. But I'm changing so fundamentally in that I want to calm down and I don't want big rows. I actually don't want to even be around people who I don't like anymore. I'm just sick of the pretense of it all.
Yes.
And that's me in my 40s, how I've changed. So when you get to your age, with all due respect, how much do you change in terms of what you want to do? That's it. Are you prioritising things you want to do?
Yes, more? I'm prioritising time off. I'm caught between two things. I have a great fear that if I give up completely and do nothing, do no radio, no television, no shows around the country, no nothing, I will go into gaga land very quickly. And I want to sort of ward that off. I think you have to keep the mind alive and you have to be occupied with something.
Are you frightened of old age, though?
No, I cannot believe I'm 80 years of age, because my father, amongst other people, died at 58. A big, strong, healthy, wiry man who worked all his life in the outdoors, and he barrels of Guinness's stout around the place for a living, and he died at 58. And here I am, 80 years of age, and I am puny in physique by comparison with him. But yet I've made 80 years of age, and I can't believe it. And Kathleen is 80 years of age this week, and she can't believe it either, because we don't feel 80 and we don't look 80. We know we don't look 80.
But when you get to 80, have you started thinking about death? Contemplating
Of course you think about death. Of course you do. But I think you'd think about death far earlier than 80 years of age.
And in what way have you thought about it?
Well, I know it's coming, and it's going to get here for me long before it gets here for you, for example. And so I'm not afraid of it. I don't dwell on it. I don't worry about it. But my main aim is to realise now that, in fact, every day is a bonus. Every day. And I used to hear my mother and father, indeed, say things like this. I didn't really believe them when I was a kid. But every day you can get out of bed and stand up straight. That's a good day. Every day is a good day if you're well and healthy and moving and doing things.
We've been having a conversation on the radio show, Gay, over recent times with people about how, when they get to the end of their life, them choosing how they die and the fear associated with not having a choice for yourself. Be it that you become incapacitated, you have to go into a home, or indeed you have a terminal illness and you can't die. Have you thought those things through for yourself?
Well, that's the dread of everybody. My dread would be that I would lie a long time in an awful pain. They assure me now you don't have to lie a long time in awful pain, but your dread is that you lie a long time in awful pain and disability and so on. I'd rather it happened very, very quickly and gone. Thank you. Goodbye. Lights out. Good luck.
But if it didn't, would you want to be able to take your own life?
Yes, I think there's a great deal of rationality behind that, and I think it is a choice that people can make. And if you are facing into a long, drawn-out, terrible illness of great pain, I think that is an option.
And might you do it?
I think you would have to. I think I would have to consider it. I think I would have to consider it, although it is against all the tenets of everything we have been taught. But more and more people are realising that's the way out, and maybe we should take it. Please do not ask me to make this decision this morning.
No, I'm not. I'm grateful for you being so open about it. I was talking to Richard and Judy about it, and they've made a pact with each other.
To do what?
Well, if one asks the other to help end their life, right, they'll do it.
Right. Yes. Well, I can imagine that. I can imagine that, and I think it's increasingly an option now for people.
Have you discussed it with your wife?
No. No, I'm only discussing it with you because you're asking me about it.
You're 50 years married this year, by the way.
50 years 50 married.
50 years.
This year. And
wow.
Don't ask me about the secret of a happy marriage either. For God's sake, spare me that.
No, I won't. I guess I was going to say to you, my goodness, again, a lifetime with one individual. You can tell us what love means.
I think it settles down into an acceptance one of the other, and when I've been asked what's the secret of a happy marriage, the secret is...
I didn't ask you. You didn't want me to ask you, so don't you start answering it.
No, I'm saying when I am asked, other people have asked me, and my pat answer is, the secret of a happy marriage is just do what you're damn well told, when you're told to do it. Report for duty, do it. Salute three times and say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, three bags full, ma'am. That's the easy way to get out.
Here's the last question. What is Northern Ireland important to you? Do you like it up here? I know your parents married during the First World War.
My parents married there, yes, indeed. Don't let me go before I tell you. We're in Newry on the 20th of November. Oma on the 21st and Enniskillen on the 22nd.
So you've still got a lot of energy and you're getting about the country, sir.
So we're getting around the country and meeting people, and we've been so lucky so far with our stage show because we've had beautiful audiences and they've been very, very appreciative, and they are of a certain style of person, which I like.
OK. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, and I wish I could talk to you for a lot longer. OK, thank you and continued success, sir.
Thank you, Stephen, and say hello to all your listeners on our behalf.
So there we go. Gay Byrne's up here in Belfast tonight. That's actually sold out. Thursday, November the 20th at the Canal Court Hotel in Uri. Next year, in January, in Oma on the 21st and in Enniskillen on the 22nd. Thanks for your company today. We'll see you tomorrow.